You know, it wasn't that many years ago that ads featuring prominent stars like Tom Brady, Kim Kardashian, Matt Damon started coming on. I remember some during a Super Bowl a few years ago, touting all the benefits of investing in digital currency. You know, FTX, crypto.com, things along that nature. And it's amazing how it doesn't take very many years for things to turn sideways. As their rise and fall drew in and destroyed many investors' savings who trusted these endorsements, people do what they do, right? We look for someone to blame and someone to sue. And there are several current pending lawsuits against people like Tom Brady for people losing their investments by investing in what was in essence fairly risky materials. This is not a new type of thing. Celebrities like Joe Namath, among many others, have been on the flip side of for insurance products that were not very good, investment opportunities where someone coming in and saying, I think this is great, turned into a disaster, not only for the people who trusted them, but then in return for those celebrities who endorsed it. Celebrities who really just took a job promoting a product or investment only to have it turn into a public relations nightmare in the best case scenario and a lawsuit on the other side. Most of the time, their defense ends up being they didn't understand the product that they were endorsing. You know, after all, if we really stop and think about it, Tom Brady and Joe Namath, they're trained to read defenses, not investment portfolios, not insurance documentation. You know, Matt Damon or Matt McConaughey are paid to memorize lines and deliver them convincingly, not understand cryptocurrency or car parts. My concern this morning that we'll see that Paul also shares is this. What's our defense for believing the celebrities who endorse these things? All the data that's out there shows that we do. Whether or not we think we do or not, when a celebrity tells us that something is or isn't, whether it's a product, an investment, a political position, whatever it is, when celebrities speak, we give to them a level of trust and belief that sometimes doesn't pay off. In fact, most of the time, doesn't pay off. Marketing companies are many things, but they're not stupid, and they pay huge amounts of money in order to borrow power from those people who have it in order to convince us of where to put or spend our money. The reality is just that we are more easily persuaded by those that we perceive to be successful, smart, or experienced. You know, following the success of the TV show ER, many reportedly, there was some polling data that showed many people viewed George Clooney as reliable when it came to offering medical advice. This makes me think of the old church. I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV, you know. Recently, there was a new Toyota ad that says, you know, said something to the effect of 9 out of 10 dentists, recommend buying a Toyota Prius. And just as a way of kind of playing humorously on this trend, we build an emotional connection with actors and athletes. We form positive associations that we simply take for granted. As J.R.R. Tolkien once wrote, that not all that glitters is gold. This is Paul's frustration, and it's his warning that we find in 2 Corinthians 11 and 12. We saw last week the heart and the humility behind his argument. Now we kind of get the punch that comes on the other side of that humility. Though Paul is the one who came to them with the gospel, who demonstrated selfless sacrifice to pour into them, to disciple them, a combination of false teachers and showy preachers have started to turn them against Paul and ultimately turn them against the gospel. Let me just read the first few verses from chapter 11 here, 1 through 4. It says, I wish you would put up with a little foolishness from me. And here's where you can really start to hear Paul get emotional. He says, yes, do put up with me, for I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy because I have promised you in marriage to one husband to present a pure virgin to Christ. But I fear that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your minds may be seduced from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if a person comes and preaches another Jesus, whom we did not preach, or you receive a different spirit which you had not received, or a different gospel which you had not accepted, you put up with it splendidly. As we learned last week, the issue for Paul isn't that his pride is being wounded, but instead that he is seeing them lose sight of the gospel, of the person of Jesus. And they're starting to focus on what they want to hear, what they're attracted to, what they're drawn to, rather than the truth of the story of Jesus. And for them, and for us, the reality is this is a difficult thing to see in ourselves. It's a tough one to notice in ourselves. You know, we are just amazing at confusing what looks good with what is good. We're good at confusing what looks good with what is good. You know, I've watched over and over, both in local church settings and across Christian celebrity culture, in both liberal and conservative churches, this phenomenon take place. I've seen it in myself and people that I care about. And as a pastor, it's one of those thoughts that makes me nervous. If I don't guard my own teaching and doctrine, I could do the same thing. The question we have to address is if we're going to protect ourselves, but also protect others from ourselves. You know, because here's the reality: we may not be celebrities, but we're still endorsers. When we back something, when we say this is something that I'm excited about, we're communicating something. We influence one another, and when we follow something or someone that seems good but isn't, others are impacted by our decisions in that area. Even more concerning to Paul is that the advancement of the gospel is being impacted by these decisions that are happening in Corinth. We'll look at that, but as is so often the case with Paul's letters, something that has broad kingdom application is also very deeply personal. Because when we confuse what looks good with what is good, it impacts the way we view ourselves, God, and others. And when we change the way we look at God, ourselves, and others, it changes the way we love God, love people, and make disciples. We can learn from this church in Corinth because, like we can do, they confused what looked good with what was actually good. And so Paul responds by exposing three false ways that we can measure strength. But we can measure goodness. We can measure someone who's worth listening to. And then he's going to show us where true strength is found. Here's 11, 5 and 6, as well as 13 through 15 for our first picture of false strength. He says, "Now I consider myself in no way inferior to those super apostles. Even if I am untrained in public speaking, I am certainly not untrained in knowledge. Indeed, we have in every way made that clear to you in everything." And then moving forward to 13 through 15, he says, "For such people are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it's no great surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will be according to their works." False strength number one, then, is appearance. That idea of when we want to look strong, or when we respond to someone who looks strong, looks talented, looks credible. Paul writes, "I consider myself in no way inferior to those super apostles." He says, "Even if I'm untrained in public speaking, I am not untrained in knowledge," Paul says to them. Now, the phrase "untrained in public speaking" hit the Corinthians right in the space where they lived. They loved rhetoric. This was, you know, they didn't have cable TV or satellite, or they couldn't even stream YouTube. They had the public speakers. They were the entertainment of the day, coming with their great ideas, and there was this highly trained school of them, and that was their sport. They didn't have football. Poor people. They had to deal with listening to people talk as a sport. You know, the best speakers could move an audience with their tone, with their rhythm, with their posture. It was entertainment as much as persuasion. So when Paul came along without polish, without charisma, without that wow factor, they dismissed him. They assumed that weakness in presentation was equal to a weakness in message. If Paul were around today, he'd probably have a small YouTube channel with like 120 subscribers and terrible lighting going on. Meanwhile, these super apostles would be verified influencers. They'd probably have their own merch line, plenty of sponsorships. They would look like success. Paul says, don't confuse the shine with the substance. There's this great moment in Acts 20 when we read that Paul, traveling through on his way to Jerusalem, he talked on and on and on, and a young man named Eutychus, who was sitting in a windowsill, fell asleep, fell out of the window, and died. And Paul went out there, looked over him, reached down, embraced him, prayed for him. He came back to life. Paul says, it's all right, he's okay. Then Paul goes back inside, keeps talking until dawn. So next time I go until 12:05, it could be worse. But even in that story, we can pick up on something powerful happening here. The miracle isn't that Paul raised somebody from the dead. It's God's presence. The Spirit worked through Paul not because he was impressive, but because he was faithful. And that's true for us too. How often do we judge others or even ourselves by appearance? We might think, if I were more confident, if I were more gifted, if I were more organized, then God could use me. Then God could use me if only I was more like this. Or we look at someone else and assume they have it all together when really all it means when they look all together is they're better at hiding their insecurities and their struggles. But God has never been impressed by appearances. 1 Samuel 16:7 says, man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Isaiah 53 tells us that God's anointed one had no form or majesty that we should desire him. That's the Savior of the world who, later on we would read those words applied to Jesus, didn't look like one. So when you feel unimpressive, when your life looks plain, when your gifts seem small, remember that it's often exactly where God's power shows up more clearly. It's not the polish, it's the presence. It's not the skill, it's the surrender. There's nothing wrong with developing skill and polish. Those are not bad things in and of themselves. In fact, Paul talked in 1 Corinthians about Apollos, who was a very good public speaker. There's nothing wrong with Apollos. And he encouraged people, whether you like to listen to me or whether or not you listen to Apollos, that's great. So if we don't judge the material by how the presenter looks or sounds, and we don't limit ourselves by that same measure, then maybe Paul is going to infer here, he's going to say, maybe it's about what we achieve. Maybe that's how we can judge someone's strength. Well, let me read 16 through 23. It says, I repeat, let no one consider me a fool. But if you do, at least accept me as a fool so that way I can boast a little. What I am saying is this, matter of boasting. I don't speak as the Lord would, but as it were, foolishly, since many boast according to the flesh, I will also boast. For you, being so wise, gladly put up with fools. You can see there's a little sarcasm weaving through here in Paul's language. He says, in fact, you put up with it if someone enslaves you, if someone exploits you, if someone takes advantage of you, if someone is arrogant towards you, if someone slaps you in the face. I say this to our shame. We have been too weak for that. But in whatever anyone dares to boast, I'm talking foolishly, I also dare. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I'm talking like a madman. I am a better one. With far more labors, far more imprisonments, far worse beatings, many times near death. Paul's going to go on for a bit here about all the hurt and the toil and the struggle that he endured. And he does this for a good reason, because as we can confuse appearance with goodness, we can also mistake achievement for goodness. And here Paul does something that I find brilliant. He starts boasting, but this boasting, it's satire. This is him holding up a mirror to say, hey, I want you to see what those people are doing. He goes, and tell you what, I'm going to do a little bit of it myself, just to help you see the problem here. He says, if you want to compare resumes, he's like, let's do it. He's like, I got a resume too. He lists everything he's been through, and he'll talk further on. He'll go 5 times whipped with the 39 lashes, 3 times beaten with rods, 1 stoned and left for dead, shipwrecked, hungry, thirsty, sleepless, cold, naked. He goes like, this isn't a highlight reel. This sounds like a hospital report. These super apostles were bragging about their spiritual achievements, how many people they influenced, how strong they appeared under pressure. And Paul says, hey, you know what? If suffering disqualifies me in your eyes, he goes, you've misunderstood the gospel. If suffering disqualifies me as being an apostle, then you've misunderstood the gospel. It's interesting, in Philippians 3, 4 through 8, Paul kind of does a similar thing where he runs out his resume a little bit, all the reasons he could brag, Hebrew of Hebrews, Pharisee, blameless under the law. And then he ends that by saying, I count it all as loss compared to knowing Christ. All the achievement is loss when you set it up next to knowing Jesus. We can do this too. We may not say it out loud. I don't think most of us are bold enough to brag in this same way, but we tend to keep our own score. We judge by success in numbers, attendance, sales, recognition, likes, promotions, even how together our family looks. We might go, at least my family doesn't look like that, or at least, you know, my marriage looks like this instead of that, or whatever it might be. We have our own scorecards that we tend to draw up when we're comparing to others, or when we're looking at someone else who we would want to, you know, who we're looking to as an influence. We might go, well, look at their scorecard, look at all they've done in that. And when our lives tend to not measure up, we often feel like failures because of it. But the gospel is one of those things that just keeps flipping the scoreboard on us. You know, Jesus says things like in Matthew 20:16, where he says, the last will be first. He celebrates the widow's two coins over the rich man's excessive giving. He calls a group of fishermen and tax collectors to change the world. You know, Paul's boasting here isn't pride. It's a parody. He's showing that endurance that comes from love means a lot more than performance that comes from pride. To be honest, achievement is intoxicating. Like, it felt good to have so many kids come through Fall Fest, right? I mean, like, if you were here, it was exciting. There's something very fun about that. It says, yes, all the work and labor we put in is worth it because X number of kids came through. But I think sometimes we forget that if one kid came through, then it was probably still worth it for that one kid. Yeah, I remember that being very much the way I thought when I was a young youth pastor. It'd be like, if I only had 3 or 4 kids show up for an event, you know. Sometimes I was even tempted to be like, you know, we'll just kind of hang out. We won't get into the, it's like, no. Like, the lesson's just as important for them as if I had 50 kids here. Because no achievement can ever be enough for more than just a moment. You see, when our achievements become our source of worth, or a source of measurement for someone else, it's never going to be enough. Because eventually they will let us down, or eventually we will let us down. Or we won't, yeah, we will be like, oh, well, I accomplished that yesterday. I achieved that yesterday, but boy, I haven't done anything lately. In ministry, I've had moments where I thought, if this event, service, camp, if this sermon is good, if the numbers look right, then I know I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. But that kind of thinking turns ministry into performance, and that's true in any ministry, not just in a professional ministry setting. And it makes the gospel something that we achieve instead of something that we receive, something that we accomplish instead of something that we accept. See, God doesn't call us to prove ourselves. He calls us to trust him. And that's what Paul is showing us, that every beating he endured, every sleepless night, every bit of endurance was proof of his trust in God, not his worth, because he accomplished something. That's the upside-down power of the gospel. Success isn't proof of faith. Faithfulness is proof of faith. You know, even if we stop chasing appearance or achievement, though, Paul warns us of one more trap in this text. We can try to feel our way to strength, to build confidence through experiences. 2 Corinthians 12, 1-6, Paul goes on here. He says, boasting is necessary. It's not profitable. But I will move on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who was caught up to the third heaven 14 years ago. Whether he was in the body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows. I know that this man, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know, God knows, was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words which a human being is not allowed to speak. I will boast about this person, but not about myself, except of my weaknesses. For if I want to boast, I wouldn't be a fool, because I would be telling the truth, but I will spare you so that no one can credit me with something beyond what he sees in me or hears from me. We can easily become people who value experience over substance. Paul shifts gears here a little bit. After listing his scars, he starts talking about visions and revelations. He says, I know a man in Christ who was caught up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body. He says, I don't know. God knows. I like that he says that twice. Footnote here, that phrase, the third heaven, you don't need to try to decode that. That was just a way of, like, the sky, like where the clouds are, that was heaven one. Where the stars are, that's heaven two. Heaven three is that spot we can't see, and that's where God is. That was the way the Greek, kind of the Greco-Roman world looked at the when they talked about the heavens. They used kind of that. So that idea is that heaven three, that's paradise. Now, most scholars assume that Paul is talking about himself here, but he's so careful not to boast about it that he talks about the experience in kind of this third person, like, oh, this isn't me. And most people are like, yeah, I'm pretty sure Paul was using a literary device here that he was saying, I am talking about me. I just don't want to talk about it like it's me. In essence, yes, I had an encounter with God that would blow your mind, but that's not the thing that defines me. That's not the thing I want to talk about when I talk about me. Which I have to go, if there was ever a trump card you could play on the spiritual experience thing, I feel like that would be it. You know, if somebody comes up and goes, oh, I had a really good quiet time with the Lord this morning. Yeah, me too. I was in heaven last week. So, you know, just saying. But Paul's not going to use his spiritual experiences as leverage. He's not going to use this moment of revelation as a way to put himself over someone else. He says, I will not boast about myself except about my weaknesses. Because even experiences can become idols if they replace trust. You know, this is really where we kind of need to go back to what he already told the Corinthian church back in 1 Corinthians 12 through 14. I don't know if you remember that kind of sermon series when we were in that section. They were obsessed, this church in Corinth, with the dramatic spiritual gifts. They were really excited about, you know, speaking in tongues and prophecies and miracles, and they wanted, you know, the bigger, showier things and kind of, hey, everybody, look at me type of gifts. They treated gifts like trophies instead of like tools. They wanted the spotlight rather than the service. And so Paul had to remind them, 1 Corinthians 12:4, he says, there are different gifts, but the same Spirit. And the purpose of every gift, which we spent all of chapter 13 talking about, or Paul spends all of chapter 13 saying, the purpose of all of those gifts is love. That's the reason that those gifts exist, is so that we can love one another by what God has gifted us to give to someone else. Without love, Paul would say, those gifts are noise. They're gongs. Symbols. They sound impressive, but they're not very life-giving. And here in 2 Corinthians, that same truth is echoing forward for us. He's saying, you think power is something flashy, something emotional, something overwhelming, but I've learned that power isn't about what I feel, it's about who I trust. You know, sometimes I often hear people, and I've heard myself express the same thing, where you just go, you know, I just don't feel close to God. I just don't feel as close to God anymore as I used to. Just, it feels like there's this distance here. And I get that. I've been there. But closeness to God isn't proven by feelings. It's grown by faith. Faith isn't an emotion that we chase. It's obedience that we practice. That's why in John 20, Jesus tells Thomas, you know, we call him Doubting Thomas, because before Jesus showed back up after the resurrection, he said, I won't believe it till I see it, till I touch his hands and, you know, see him right here in person. And then Jesus shows up and Thomas is like, all right, I'm there, I believe. And Jesus says to him, you believe because you've seen me. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Faith that only exists when we feel something isn't faith. Faith that only exists when we feel something isn't faith. Paul reminds us that even the most dramatic experiences can't hold a candle to simple trust. I think back to some of the most intense spiritual experiences I've had over my life, and they don't actually change anything. The thing that changes something is when you're going through one of those desert and dry times. In fact, that's why God often led his people through deserts. And trusting in the midst of those times, it actually gives you the strength to walk through the next one, the strength to trust. Experiences fade. Feelings shift around. But God's grace never does. And that really brings us to the core of this message, the part that ties it all together. If appearance, achievement, and experience fall short of showing us what actually following Jesus, what actual like strength, spiritual strength is, what actually makes us strong. Let me read 2 Corinthians 12, 7 through 10. Especially because of the extraordinary revelations, kind of finishes the end of a sentence there. So this, therefore, so that I would not exalt myself, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to torment me so that I would not exalt myself. Concerning this, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it would leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect, my power is perfected in weakness. Therefore, I will most gladly boast all the more about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may reside in me. So I take pleasure in weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and in difficulties for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Talk about counterintuitive. Hanging in our dining room window is a window. Or hanging in our dining room, not in our dining room window. Hanging in our dining room is a window. Not in the wall, on the wall. There was a particularly painful season in our lives. I felt weak. I felt like a failure. I was broken and wondered, genuinely, has my usefulness to God run its course at this point? And that's when this verse just sprang to life. This is, I don't know, 15 or more years ago. This verse all of a sudden just sprang to life. And so I found an old, weak and ratty-looking, wood-framed, single-pane window at a thrift shop. And with poor artistry, I painted a part of this passage on the back side of the glass so that way it would shine through. And I tell you what, some of you who are really artistic, you know, Kelly and Cam and others who can paint really well, it's hard to paint letters backwards. It's a difficult trick. But I put it that there so that way it would shine through, because in that verse, which is now absolutely one of my favorites, I discovered where real gospel power comes from. It comes from weakness. It comes from that place of saying, I've got nothing left. I don't bring anything to this at the end of the day. Gospel power becomes strength when we can be weak. It says, therefore, so I would not exalt myself. Paul's been blessed with all of these great experiences and moments, and so for some reason, it says that a thorn in the flesh was given to me. He describes it as a messenger from Satan to torment me, so that I would not exalt myself. Something to, God put something in his life to kind of bring him down a notch. Because apparently God knew Paul was prone to a little bit of arrogance or a little bit of jumping up. We don't know what the thorn is. There's a lot of debate in scholarly circles about what this thorn in the flesh may be. Some people think it was physical pain. Some think it might have been emotional suffering, persecution, anxiety. One of the most persuasive to me is that it actually involved the loss of his eyesight. In the book of Galatians, he comments on, when he came to them, he came in affliction, and kind of he came in sick, but he doesn't get super specific, but he comments that when he came like that, that they said, he says, you would have given me your eyes if you could have. And so there's other places where he references to, like, when he writes something with his own hand, he talks about it being in extra large letters. So it's like maybe there was some sort of eyesight loss, which would have been a huge vulnerability in the world of the first century. I mean, certainly a huge vulnerability today, but imagine in a space before a world that it really is geared to protect people who have those kinds of challenges. Regardless of what it was, though, the point was it was painful, it was persistent, and it was humbling. And Paul begged God 3 times to take it away. He says, God, I'm tired of hurting like this. Will you take this away from me? And 3 times, God said no. Ever been there? Ever begged God to answer a prayer, to heal a wound, to resolve a tension, to explain a question, and just heard no? Or worse, maybe just heard nothing. You're in good company if you've experienced that. Paul knew what you're going through. It was in that place where I was at my weakest when I really discovered the power of this verse and so painted my window with its words. Because then came the answer that redefined Paul's entire understanding of strength. He says, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in weakness. Therefore, I will most gladly boast all the more about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may reside in me. So I take pleasure in my weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and in difficulties for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong. It's one of the most beautiful and disruptive truths in the Bible. God didn't say, my grace will remove your weakness. He said, my grace will use it. It will fill it. It will do something through it. It is where strength is perfected. And Paul says something even more radical. He says, therefore, I will most gladly boast all the more about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may reside in me. He says, I want to experience Christ's power. And so you know what? I'm going to sit in my weakness. In essence, he's not just accepting weaknesses. He is celebrating his weaknesses. How often do we do that? Just as a side note, how often do we do that with one another? How often do we celebrate someone else's weakness instead of complaining about it? Because the weaknesses that used to feel like failure have now become a window for grace that God can use there. See, this is where Paul's theology becomes very personal. We spend so much of our lives defending, proving, protecting our image, even if only for ourselves. But Paul's greatest defense here isn't an argument. It's dependence. When God said, my grace is sufficient, he was inviting Paul into something new, not striving but resting, not performing but trusting. To trust God is to rest in what he provides. To rest doesn't mean giving up. It doesn't mean we go, well, this is my weakness, so I'm just going to, it doesn't mean giving up. It means letting go of the illusion that you have that kind of control, that you're in control. It's shifting from I've got this to he's got me. Shifting from I've got this to he's got me. Psalm 46:10 says, be still and know that I am God. It's not a call to laziness. It means stop fighting battles that aren't yours. You can't be still if you're still proving. That's the invitation of grace. To stop pretending to be strong and start being honest about the fact that you have a need. Because when you do, you allow for the space where God can show his power. And this is then in contrast to those that he called the super apostles. Remember at the very beginning of this kind of little discourse that he's on, he talked about those super apostles, the false teachers that were impressive. They seemed strong. They seemed competent. He says, show me what they look like when everything goes wrong. Show me who they are and how their teaching stands when they suffer, when they fail, when there isn't a big experience to hang their hat on. Because what's left when everything else gets taken away? Paul says, what I learned is that his grace is sufficient for me, for his power is perfected in weakness. And so instead, he boasts all the more about those weaknesses so that Christ's power can reside in him. I thought about this. I thought, for our church, for us, this is something incredibly hopeful, something that I think was illustrated even yesterday. We we aren't a big church. We might not be a big church. We may not have the flashiest building. We don't have a big staff. We don't have a big budget. But none of those things ever made a church powerful. They can make a church big, but they don't make it powerful. God delights to work through what looks small, ordinary, weak even, because that's how his glory gets seen. That's how his glory gets seen. So where does the church grow the fastest? If we look around the world, it's not in the nations where the church is strong. It's where all the circumstances conspire against it. And they don't grow by strength, but by dependence and simply following Jesus into loving obedience into the lives of those who need him. You know, if you think about the feeding of the 5,000 in John 6 and recorded other words, you know, Jesus didn't need a banquet hall. He didn't need a catering company. He needed a boy's lunch. He didn't multiply from abundance. He multiplied from dependence. He multiplied from faith and obedience. The miracle began the moment someone was willing to say, hey, it's not much, but it's yours. It's kind of weak. It doesn't have a lot to it, but what can you do with that? When we stop trying to look strong, God finally gets to show us what his strength can do. And now Paul closes this whole thought with tenderness. He's not angry. He kind of comes across with that. I don't know if you've ever spent time with someone who's really heartbroken. You're like, why are they so angry? And until all of a sudden you realize, oh, they're not angry. They're heartbroken. They're brokenhearted. I think that's Paul's tone here, but he's also hopeful. Listen to his heart in these last verses that we'll cover today, 11 through 21. It says, I have been a fool. You forced it on me. You ought to have commended me, since I am not in any way inferior to those super apostles, even though I am nothing. The signs of an apostle were performed with unfailing endurance among you, including signs and wonders and miracles. So in what way are you worse off than the other churches, except that I personally did not burden you? Forgive me for this wrong. Look, I am ready to come to you this third time. I will not burden you, since I am not seeking what is yours, but you. For children ought not to save up for their parents, but parents for their children. I will most gladly spend and be spent for you. If I love you more, am I to be loved less? He says, now granted, I did not burden you, yet sly as I am, I took you in by deceit. Did I take advantage of you by any of those I sent you? Because I urged Titus to go. I sent the brother with him. Titus didn't take advantage of you, did he? Didn't we walk in the same spirit and in the same footsteps? Have you been thinking all along that we were defending ourselves to you? No. In the sight of God, we are speaking in Christ, and everything, dear friends, is for building you up. For I fear that perhaps when I come, I will not find you to be what I want, and you may not find me to be what you want. Perhaps there will be quarreling, jealousy, angry outbursts, selfish ambitions, slander, gossip, arrogance, and disorder. He goes, I fear that when I come, my God will again humiliate me in your presence, and I will grieve for many who sinned before and have not repented of the moral impurity, sexual immorality, and sensuality that they practiced. So those are all the dangers of following the wrong strength. A lack of repentance, a lack of love. A lack of even seeing the good things that come when they come. Paul's big argument there is he's like, when I went to Philippi, the Philippians supported me financially. Like, when I went to Galatia, the Galatian church supported me financially. He goes, I never put that burden on you. Was that my mistake? That I didn't take advantage of you the way I took advantage of others? Instead, I poured out for you. He's like, but you don't even see it that way. Instead, you see it as me being weak. Paul's concerned about who they follow because there is danger in following the wrong strength. I love what he said in verse 19. He says, everything we do, dear friends, is for your strengthening. All of Paul's critique and heartbreak and everything he's pouring out in these letters, he says, that's not me trying to get something for me. He's like, this is me trying to get something for you. This is me trying to help you turn the page, to move forward, to grow, to step into the fullness of the gospel. And that's the heartbeat of this whole letter, really both of these letters that Paul has written to the church in Corinth. Paul's not after power. He's not after recognition. He's after their restoration, their growth, their strength, their joy. And he's afraid that they're mistaking noise for depth, confidence for truth, and performance for the presence. He's afraid they're going to miss the beauty of weakness, the very place where God's power can be perfected. The danger for us isn't that we're weak. The danger for us, the danger for you and I, is not that we are weak. The danger is that we'll waste our weakness by hiding it or hiding from it. The tragedy isn't being small. It's chasing significance apart from Jesus. But the opportunity is enormous. Because if God's power is perfected in weakness, then we are in the perfect position when we are weak for him to move. And when we will own that we are weak for him to do something. When we hear, "You're too small," God says, "You're just right. You're right where I want you to be, because this is where I can come in and add strength." When we hear, "You don't have enough," God says, "My grace is enough." When we hear, "You're not strong enough," God says, "That's where my power shines." That's the gospel. That's the good news. Jesus didn't win by looking powerful. He didn't win by achieving success. He didn't win by performing wonders. Oh, Jesus did lots of great, powerful things. He achieved some success. I mean, if you got 5,000 people coming to you for a lunch, that's a big deal. That was a big event that he held that could have been a great success. And he performed some amazing miracles. But none of those things are what accomplished his purposes. He won by surrendering. He didn't say it is finished after he fed 5,000. He didn't say it is finished after restoring sight to the blind. He said it is finished after the end of the cross. He didn't come down from the cross to prove his strength. He stayed there to demonstrate his love. And his weakness, his suffering, became the very power that raised him from the dead. And that's the power that he offers to us. Your weakness isn't your failure. It's your invitation. Your weakness is the space where grace can take root. It's the spot where the seed can be planted. Because when you are weak, then, Paul says, then you are strong. I want to read verses 9 and 10 one more time. "I will most gladly boast all the more about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may reside in me. Therefore, I take pleasure in weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and in difficulties for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Let me ask the worship team to go ahead and come on back up. If you've been fighting to hold it together, to try to appear strong, to try to prove that you're enough, trying to keep up a show, let this be your invitation to rest. Let this be your invitation to rest. Whether it's for the first time or coming once again to the foot of the cross, it's an invitation to rest, an invitation to stop striving and to start surrendering, because grace doesn't flow to the proud, it flows to the humble. And in that humility, we find the strength that lasts forever. Let me pray. Father, I just thank you that your power is made perfect in weakness. God, that the invitation for us is not to try to accomplish something, not to try to prove something, not to show off. The invitation is to surrender to what you've already done. That you have all the strength, that you designed us from the very beginning to operate in your strength, to operate in community and in perfect communion with you. And that invitation still stands. And every time we try to go and do it on our own, every time we try to look to the big and the impressive, to the showy, we end up falling for something that's just not real. An investment scheme that won't pay off. But God, when we are open to you about our weakness, We simply confess, God, I need you. You are so faithful and so good and so mighty to do more than we can ask or imagine. And so, God, we just surrender ourselves to you this morning. Lord, give us the freedom. Show us how to come in humility and own our weaknesses before you. To paint on our own windows that it is when we are weak that you are strong. And to remind us day by day how deeply we need you and how much you love us. And how much you are willing to give us the strength we need to do all that you've asked us to do, to live the life that you've called us to serve others, to serve our families and our communities and our workplaces the way you've called us to. God, I thank you for your love. I thank you for the power you give us. Lord, thank you for the thorns in our flesh that remind us that we have a need. Teach us to listen to those. Teach us to respond to those.